This is the second cassette in the interview with Representative Ann C. Barnes on Monday, November 27, 1995, for the Southern Oral History Program's The North Carolina Politics Project series. This is cassette number 11.27.95-AB.2. We were just talking about the reemergence of the Republican Party and just turning to that issue. And 94, of course, caps this great realignment in the state's voting patterns and the number of members of the General Assembly. Stepping back and trying to draw the broadest sense of all of this change, what sorts of factors would you point to as being the ones most responsible for this broad realignment of party politics in North Carolina?
Well, it is not separate and apart from what's going on in the rest of the country.
Sure.
I think national politics have impacted what happens in state politics and parties, and the national politics has not worked to the advantage of the Democratic Party in this state. It considers itself a more conservative state than the national ticket would indicate, and so that has not been a help, I think, to Democrats getting elected in North Carolina by and large. It hasn't hurt me, because the national ticket has always prevailed in Orange County and Chatham County also. So my particular district is still somewhat in tune with the national ticket, but the national ticket is perceived by the nation as being more conservative than the nation is, and certainly more conservative than most of the southern states, North Carolina included. So a part of what happened here was a national movement. Another part of what happened was a new kind of campaigning, and Democrats have been slow to adopt that new kind of campaigning. It's negative, and it's slick, and it does not always have much to do with the truth, and that's the way I see it. Also, it's clever because it built the right networks. It's clever because it found some national buttons to push, and it pushed them all the way down to the school board races in every place in America. That was clever. I don't admire it much, not just because it didn't go my way, but because I don't care for that kind of campaigning that sometimes operates on half-truths and innuendo. But it worked. It's about power. And there are those in the Republican Party and those who advise them who know how to get power and how to get votes. And so I give them their due in knowing how to do it, planning it, and being disciplined enough to carry it out in every community across the country, and as well as North Carolina. It worked. It's a campaign that worked in 1994. It was different from other campaigns. The negativism had been there for some time, and here I think it started with Jesse Helms' campaign, but that'd been there, but this was more than that, as best I can see it, and other people who are political analysts would know more than I do, but my gut feelings about it and just my observation is that it was a well-orchestrated campaign that worked. Not one that I admire much, the tactics and the strategies, et cetera, but one that that worked. It got the right voters out for them. Meanwhile, there was apathy occurring in other places, and that hurt. So I don't know if that was just a general complacency, or if it was we don't have anything to worry about. Our people always get elected, or well, with registered Democrats outnumbering Republicans, how could we lose? I don't know why people didn't come and vote. The people who we have depended on to vote Democratic didn't come and vote in as large a numbers. But the other people were stimulated to come out, and it was very well organized, and they did. And I think it even surprised them. In North Carolina, I think there were people who filed for legislative offices that had no idea in this world that they would win. Just none. Had no idea, and boom-o, woke up the next day, and they were legislators. It was good politicking on their part, on the part of the Republican Party.
Why have the voters responded the way they have?
I don't know.
I
wish I knew the answer to that. If I did, I would go and be a well high-paid political consultant. But I'm not an analyst, and as I said, I'm in an atypical situation here. The only thing typical about this situation in 94 was that the apathy extended into the progressive Democratic ranks, and our numbers did not turn out in the ways that they have in some other times, and I have yet to understand that. Maybe it's a wake-up call, and the next election will tell us something about that. I don't know that, but I think a lot of it was hitting on those buttons that a little bit like scare tactics of the things that they could push buttons on with a certain segment, and like crime and taxes and abortion and those hot issues, touching on those and including them in a national movement, pooling funds and getting the most out of the money that they spent, and simply getting their people out. I think that there were people who disagreed with that who stayed home and were surprised the next morning. I hope they'll never stay home again. And a job for the other philosophy of people involved with the other is to get our people out, get the message out, and maybe this was an alert that this is real and this is how it impacts you, and you can sit it out again if you want to, but you're going to get more of the same. I don't think we're really going to know until the next election how many of those people there are, because the turnout was so poor. And the people who got the turnout was the Christian right. And that was enough to swing the balance there. It's a minority group, but it's a balance swinger, in my opinion. I think that's what it is. And so you have to counteract that. And we did not counteract it. And we have been slow to adopt that kind of campaigning. I think we're going to have to be more sophisticated in our campaigning and move into some of the areas that we have not moved into.
How about your reflections on the substance of the 95 session? Impressions?
From my own point of view, it was very difficult to see an erosion of some things that I consider to be progress. And when you've invested a lot of energy and time in something, you have a special feeling about it. And so to see an erosion of what you had worked hard to get is a painful thing. I don't take it personally as against me, but against the kinds of things that I stand for and have worked for. So it was not an easy session for many of us. But it's politics. That's the way it goes. And I think the Congress, the people in the polls are turning on the Congress, on Newt Gingrich Congress. There may be some similar reaction to having gone maybe a little too far. I thought our welfare reform bill that came out of the House was a lot of steps too far, maybe maybe further than the people in North Carolina would like to go. I felt like the house position, and I'll have to say against the university, was further than our people want to go. I have to wonder if all the rattling around about vouchers and the tuition tax credits, a shift of public money into religious schools, is not something that that the public does not want and maybe now sees as a real issue and may make themselves heard on that. So there were, the concealed weapons. I'm not so sure the people really wanted that. It sounded good, you know. But we'll see whether the people really wanted that. The House Republicans' stand against Smart Start, I think, was a very unpopular stand, and I'm not sure they knew it. So if it was unpopular, it'll come back and bite them on the leg in the next election, you know. So there were some decisions that were made in the name of this is what the people said with their votes in the election, that I'm not sure that's what they said at all, you know. Mm-hmm. It might be that the people said, I want a change, you know, from business as usual. Not necessarily I want this change. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's beginning to look like maybe that's what happened with Congress. People did want a change. They didn't want business as usual, and now what they've got is more business as usual. It's just more conservative, you know. And so people ask for change for a lot of different reasons, and I don't know what all those reasons are. And anybody who says this was the message that the people sent in 94, I question that they really know that. I'm not sure what the people said, and I hope I'm smart enough to at least say I don't know what they said. It will take another election or two to know what it is that the people are saying when they vote out some people and vote in other people. But it was a difficult session for some of us, and for some others it was the best session they ever had, you know. So I try to look on this, you know, I try to take a step back from it and look on it more philosophically. Been in politics a long time, and I know these swings occur. I had worked hard to get a chairmanship, and Joe Mavridick, who's a Democrat, came along, and I lost my chairmanship then, you know. So I have experienced that before. I've experienced times in the legislature when I didn't get much help from the Democratic leadership. So I've been in the minority in a number of ways, you know, on my positions on things, my gender, you know. So this is just another minority that I'm in right now. And, of course, it's usually more pleasant to be in the majority. But it happens.
It doesn't sound. Yeah, your remarks here make it sound not as if you've lost your faith in the way the system functions. Some people I talk to these days, surveying politics over the last 10 years, they talk about, you mentioned earlier, the way campaigning has shifted so much, and particularly if you're running, not say here in a relatively small-scale House race at the state level, but mm-hmm. in a statewide race where money just becomes such a... that people have really sort of lost some of their faith in the way government is working today. But.
Well, I think that's normal, though. If not, we'd still be doing business like we did way back in another century. That has to change, and people let you know when they think change should occur. It doesn't mean the system's broken. It means the system needs to be flexible enough to change with the times and to change with the wishes of the people. I don't think it's a perfect system at all. It wasn't when Democrats ran it in the legislature, and it's not when Republicans are running it. It wasn't when we had a Republican governor, and it's not when we've got a Democratic governor. The system is never perfect, and it has to be able to withstand some change and listen. Government has to listen as best it can to when changes be there and make wise decisions and not try to interpret too much about the change, but to reevaluate what we're doing and how we're doing it, and try to be open to change. So I don't see it that as a losing faith in the system. I see it as an alert to the people are not liking the way things are being run right now. So what do we need to do different? You know, how do we change? How do we update? How do we get closer to what people feel they want their government to look like? And I think that's just a part of the process. So I don't lose faith in the whole system. You have to be willing to say, we haven't done that well. People have let us know we're not doing something very well. What is it? Let's find out what it is. How can we fix it? Let's see if they really know what they want, you know, and have a continuing dialogue with the people to make the system better and better and better. But, you know, if we throw it out, what would we replace it with? I'm not ready to throw out our system. I just think that we need to keep trying to make it better and trying to determine what the people really want, and not read too much into, throw the rascals out and get some new rascals. People get dissatisfied. Things are not going the way they'd like them to, and so they think, well, if we had new people, you know, or maybe they would change things so that it looks better, or that it feels better, it works better. So, no, I'm not totally disenchanted with our system. There are some things about it that I think have worsened. I don't like negative campaigning. I don't like the bumper sticker mentality. I think that our people deserve better than that. I think that people who are willing to run for office deserve better than that. I don't admire what's happening so much right now in regard to what's working to get power. It's negative. It's not, this is what I would do and how I would do it better. It's that those people are bad and so vote for me, you know, and I don't care for that. I think it shortchanges the whole concept of our democratic system and our political system. And so maybe it has to get even worse before it can get better. The only people that can stop that are the people themselves. And just by being fed up with being treated like they're less smart than they are. I mean, you know, I would like for the people to say, no more of this. We're going to uplift our system, not downgrade it. And we're going to have, we want more positive, we want more truths, we want more involvement in issues and not just expect us to knee-jerk respond to the bumper sticker or the 30-second ad. People will have to decide that it's only the people that can make it not work. Mm-hmm. Right now it's working. And I'm not sure all the reasons it's working. But when the people say, that's not going to get my vote anymore, they're going to have to do this, then that will change. And really, a third party might shake it up some, you know, when all this talk had come up about Colin Powell and of course, Ross Perot pushing for a third party. I just don't happen to think he's the right person for it. Maybe Colin Powell would have been the right person. Maybe some shaking up. Maybe there's more alignment that needs to be done in party politics. That would be an interesting time to live through, wouldn't it? The emergence of a real third party and some shaking up and some realignment that impacts both parties, because the Republican Party is not all Rush Limbaughs and Newt Gingriches. They're moderate. There are a lot of people in the Republican Party that are very moderate in their approach to life and politics and everything. You know, so maybe there's some things that I haven't seen in politics that it's going to happen in my lifetime that will be interesting.
Let me ask one last question about, as I mentioned before we turned the tape on to begin, one of the themes that we're exploring, and we've touched on it quite a bit, actually, in the course of our conversation, is the relative importance of certain aspects of cultural or social politics in the state's unfolding political affairs. You, through your service as co-chair of the special committee on
prisons,
mm-hmm. Became reporters frequently refer to you in the press as the House expert on prisons. And you did a lot of that work in the 80s. In 94, of course, Jim Hunt convened the special crime session. And I wonder about your thoughts, sort of surveying that span of time, your thoughts on the issue of prisons and crime in North Carolina and how it's played both sort of at the substantive and at the political level.
Well, in the beginning of my involvement by appointment of Speaker Ramsey to chair the special committee, the Standing Committee on Correction in the House, and the special committee, which had a special charge, and we worked in the interim between sessions, we were hit with lawsuits, and we had to examine what we were about. We didn't have any choice. And so we had to look at our entire system, the people we were locking up and what was happening to them, and what kinds of places we were locking them up in, and what were we accomplishing by it. And this was happening over the whole nation. There were lawsuits in almost every state in the country, and so we were all dealing with that set of issues.
Specifically about prison conditions.
Mm-hmm, prison conditions. And so in the process of that, having to dig our way out of that hole that we had found ourselves in, and what I believe was an over-reliance on incarceration, and if you can warehouse people and not damage their human their rights, their civil rights and their human rights, it isn't so expensive. But if you've got to have prisons that meet muster with the federal courts, it's more expensive. And so it became important to look at our sentencing policies to see were we locking up the right people and what were we hoping to accomplish. And that so that committee worked for 5 years, and came and we tried to stay a step ahead of the lawsuits and work our way out of a crisis. And we had to spend quite a bit of money on refurbishing our prisons and building new ones because we were overcrowded. Tried to do all of that and keep the federal courts from taking over our prison system, as they had done in many states, and it cost them even more. And so we imposed, we did something quite controversial. We imposed our the committee asked the General Assembly, and the General Assembly approved of imposing a prison cap on ourselves rather than waiting for the federal court to impose it on us, so that we could impose it in an orderly way with a plan to work our way out from under it. And so what we did as a committee is that we consulted with Governor Martin at the time, a Republican governor, Lieutenant Governor, who was presiding over the Senate, and the Speaker, and the Attorney General, and got a consensus there that we should move forward with this very controversial thing. And there was an understanding that we should keep it out of politics, that we should not politicize our situation, because we really couldn't afford to do that. We needed to deal with our problem. And so we imposed it. It was very unpopular. I didn't like it. I introduced the bill, and I didn't want to have to do that. But we were at a situation that we felt that that was the route to go. And so, and then we took on a prison building program. Now, I will say that through the Martin administration, we worked together. The legislature, all branches of government worked pretty well together to keep that from getting political. And I thought did pretty well at it. We worked with a consultant, our committee did, and when we got to a point that we felt we had patched the system as much as we could, and tried to minimize our problems in the courts, that we really needed to examine our sentencing policies so that we did not get into a situation again of a revolving door prison situation, overcrowding constantly in the courts. And so we did asked the General Assembly to dissolve the committee and to put in its place a sentencing advisory council that would come up with a new sentencing policy and to include others in that, to pull in all the players, in other words, and the judges and the DAs and the sheriffs and legislators and people who work with alternative to incarceration programs, and just to pull in all of the players to try to build some consensus around a sentencing policy that was different from the policy that we had. Mm-hmm. And so that commission worked for a couple of years and brought to the legislature a structured sentencing plan, and I introduced that bill, and we managed to get it passed the legislature, and then that was used against Democrats, even though Republicans voted for it too. It was used against Democrats. It was one of those hot buttons, and lots of things that were not true were said in the election about structured sentencing, but I suspect that some people maybe got defeated because of their support of that. But it's a policy that realigned who goes to prison and who doesn't, so that it's not a knee-jerk send everybody to prison, so that we would be able to match our policy with our resources. And if you're going to increase a sentence and have people in longer, or if you're going to put people in who are misdemeanants, because we were incarcerating misdemeanants, and only five states were incarcerating misdemeanants in their prison system. If you're going to do that, then you prepare for it so that it tracks, so that you've got the prison space. If instead of rushing in out of a campaign and introducing all these bills that greatly increase sentences and overload your prison, you would have to, in a more orderly way, match your resources to your policy. And if you are going to increase the prison population, build the prisons. You know, so it was to try to bring a match there, and that was what the sentencing policy was to do. And we passed it, and it's now law and is working, I think, well in the courts. But that was a hot button. And then, of course, all of this took place while Governor Hunt was out of office. And so we passed this new sentencing plan the first year that Governor Hunt was back, but it wasn't his. He had no investment in it. And so I thought it was great. And then we also at the same time passed his Smart Start program, which I thought would do more to prevent crime, more about the crime problem in the long run than almost anything else. So I felt like we had a good crime session in a regular session. But crime is very much on people's minds, and I think the governor surveys. He does a lot of polling and surveys and focus groups, and he found that to be an issue that people had very much on their minds. Well, you know, the General Assembly didn't invent crime, and it can't stop it 100%. We can impact it. And as in the course of the sentencing policy that we passed, we eliminated parole, and we eliminated good time that prisoners were getting automatically. So in that way, we were stopping that revolving door. We were saying, if you come in, you're not going to get out early. You're going to serve your time. But we adjusted the time served, but in no way did we make people serve less than they were already serving in practice, because they were getting paroled and they were getting good time. So the actual time served would be as much or more, except for petty misdemeanors, and we were going to handle them in the community, and that's what this sentencing policy does, unless they're repeaters, and you repeat enough, you're going to wind up in prison. But anyway, I thought it was a wonderful crime session that we had, even though we weren't calling it a crime session. So I was a little surprised when the governor said we need a crime session, and I personally thought it was a mistake to call it. That was my personal feeling, and I shared that with him, and he's the governor, and he felt that he was right, and I don't fault him for that. But my problem with it was twofold. One is it began to politicize the crime issue, and the other is that having just passed that sentencing policy, many of the proposals would have gutted that, and it took too long to get it in place, and it hadn't even been tried. You know, if you try and see it's not working, then come in and do something different. But we had just passed it, and it hadn't even gone into effect yet, and many of the proposals from the governor would have put it totally askew. So we found ourselves in the situation, some of us Democrats, of being in a different, you know, place from our Democratic governor on that set of issues. But we managed to rewrite the bills, and I thought came out so that he got much of what he had asked for in a little different form, and we preserved some of what we felt, some of us felt strongly we needed to preserve. So it was a compromise. But another reason that I feel like it's dangerous in a way to call a crime session is that the public, I'm not sure the public can be satisfied on it. You know, there's an insatiable aspect here that no matter what you do, it's never enough. Because truthfully, you can't sit in Raleigh and write laws that cause people to stop committing crimes. I'm willing to admit I cannot stop people from committing crimes. I can impact it. But there are too many factors involved. It's an oversimplification to say that tougher sentences will stop crime. It will not stop crime. It may have some impact on it somewhere down the road. But nothing short of stopping crime is going to be enough. And so when you focus on it and with the attitude of we're going to have a special crime session, and because we're going to see to it that you're safe in the street and safe in your home, and you know darn well you can't carry through on that promise. You know, it's kind of deceptive, to, in my opinion, to present it that way. And so singling out crime and focusing on it, and then you don't get the people don't get safe on the streets, and they don't get to, well, they turn on you. So, I think it was simplistic to present the picture that we could sit in Raleigh and stop crime with a special crime session. And that was what was kind of coming across. And I thought, well, no matter what we do, it will never be enough to satisfy the public because we don't have that much power. You know, crime is too complicated. And so I just felt that we didn't need to have that crime session. And that was my feeling about it. Others disagreed, and there were certainly enough legislators who felt that they did want the crime session, and the governor wanted it, and so we had it. But I felt that we minimized the damage to the new structure sentencing by rewriting the bills, and if we made the public feel safer, then there's some value in that. And just addressing it and letting the public know that we realize the seriousness of a problem, is there's some value in that. But to make assurances to the public that you cannot follow through on is not something that's attractive to me. I don't like to operate that way.
In our last few minutes, are there any matters we haven't turned to that you think we should include on the tape?
Well, I do think that one of the most serious issues facing us as a state and as a country is what happens to public education. There is an all-out attack on public education, and I think the public has got to deal with that in a reasonable and sensible way as to what it wants its public schools to be and to what extent it wants to turn its back on public schools. I think it's time for us to confirm our support of the public school system, to continue to try to make it better and more responsive, but to not just abandon it, which there is a movement toward. And it's alert time. People need to know that it's coming, it's creeping in everywhere, and while they were out shopping, their school boards were taken over by people who do not have the best interests of the public schools at heart, in my opinion. I think this is a crisis, and so it's one of the issues on the table now that I think a high-stake issue, and is something that that's going to be into politics for some time. I do not think that this new political wave that we're in right now is bodes well for women in our society. or for poor people in our society, many of whom are women, mm-hmm. and most of whom are women and children. So I'm feeling some steps backward on some progress that we've made there, and that's another issue that's very much on my mind as I have a continuing role in politics, is that some people are vulnerable now in ways that they haven't been for some time, and that we need to not lose ground in some of the progress that we have made in addressing the problems of women and poor people. Mm-hmm. Perhaps they need to be addressed in different ways. I think people are feeling that we have an imperfect net there, and it needs to be worked on. But meanwhile, the net's being thrown out, and there may be no net mm-hmm. for many, many people who need a continuing net. And so, those are some issues that I think we're not finished with yet, and that are going to be in the forefront of politics for some time to come. So, I'm alarmed about those mm-hmm. things, and those were really many of the things that got me into politics mm-hmm. to begin with, and I guess it's cyclical, and I'm not sure I realized that it was. I know that the pendulum swings right and left, but to come back around to the same problems that you had and made progress on and then to come back is really a cyclical pattern there that I was not quite prepared for. So we stand to lose some of the privileges and rights that we have gained and be back to where we were before the Great Society and before women's rights came into focus. So I hope we don't go back around that route again.
Representative Barnes, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
For all of your time and your participation.
You're welcome. I enjoyed talking with you.
Thanks very much. Mm-hmm.